Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between the well-being of individuals, communities, societies, as well as our habitat, planet Earth, and they're all interconnected. So each week on the show, as a longstanding journalist of the environment, food, health, policy, and the media, I bring in different guests and thought leaders, scientists, doctors, advocates, filmmakers, economists, all different kinds of people with different expertise that have a take on different facets of our interconnected world and how that affects us, our body politic, and our future here on planet Earth. So on today's show, I'm delighted to have a terrific guest who is a multifaceted thinker, philosopher, and enactor of social change. That's Robert Hockett, who works at the intersection of legal, financial, and philosophic subjects, both through his advisory capacity in advising several of our key and most favorite political figures and elected officials, namely Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. He also teaches at Cornell University, and he is on tap with a whole range of other activities and think tanks, and his research, writing, regular reporting, as well as convening different kinds of gatherings to kind of go at a change in paradigm about what's possible for us and for our government and for our future. So I'm delighted to welcome to Connect the Dots today, Bob Hockett. Welcome.
Hi, Allison. Oh, thanks so much for having me on. This is a milestone for me and a true honor. I've been following you for a long time, as you know, and it's just an absolute delight to finally to be on air with you.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you here. Because there's a whole overlay of the same interests and the same initiatives, and they're really key and critical ones to our future and to what my audience and a growing, higher percentage of Americans are really kind of aspiring toward, working toward, and hoping to see manifest. So let's begin with, one of your key roles is as one of the backstage architects of the Green New Deal. When the original proposal came out in February, there was tremendous excitement and a whole flurry of thought and planning and activity and debate and ridiculous responses from various quarters to it. So to many of us, this comprehensive plan really seems like the kind of expansive total social change that we really need to redress problems that have been recalcitrant in terms of, vested industries corrupting our politicians, and then enacting industrial extraction and other methods that, and other things like industrial agriculture that really undermine our climate, the integrity of our environment, and indeed the future of future generations of children and other species. So we're now four or five months down line from that initial moment. And I'm wondering from where you sit, if you can kind of give us an update on where the Green New Deal is now, what you see as initiatives happening within it, and then we can talk later afterward about, how we might expect it to unfold under a Sanders, Warren, or even long-term future AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, role in national leadership.
So, terrific question. Basically, we're going to talk a little bit then about the sort of state of play, sort of where things are now. Since the proposal of the Green New Deal resolution back in February. So here's where things currently stand. You'll recall that the proposal names sort of 14 overall sort of project areas or subject areas with which the Green New Deal will concern itself. That, of course, means, in turn, that, among other things, we have to start thinking in a bit more detail about what we actually want to do in connection with each of those 14 project areas. So that's the first observation to make. And essentially, the observations I'm about to make or that I'm making now are sort of to sort of tee up a somewhat more detailed discussion of sort of what's actually happening at this point. But to kind of frame the story of what's happening at this point, I'll first refer to those 14 subject areas. And then I'll note two other things that are worth keeping in mind. The first of the remaining two is we have to have some sort of an idea as to how the entirety of the thing would be coordinated, right? What kinds of organizational structure would be most apt to enable the Green New Deal actually to be developed, and then over time, you know, steadily to be implemented, and then finally, there's the matter that is also discussed, of course, in the resolution, of the relations among the various levels of government on the one hand, and between the public and private sectors on the other hand, both in developing the Green New Deal and, again, in implementing the Green New Deal. So in other words, we have to think a little bit about what would the role of the federal government be, what would the role of state governments be, what would the role of local governments be, and then any sort of regional groupings of states within that sort of frame on the one hand. And then again, what would the relations between any or all or any combination of those governmental units on the one hand and various private entities, be they industries or individual firms or just individual human beings, be on the other hand. All of that, those are sort of three, I'd say, very important sort of topics under which more development was left to be done back in February when the original proposal was first made. So what I'll do then is just tell you a little bit about where we are now with respect or sort of under each of those three headings. Okay.
Fantastic.
So first, when it comes to the matter of the sort of the 14 project areas, we're now sort of tentatively putting together teams of people who can sort of brainstorm together and propose ideas in connection with each of those subject areas. And these are, again, sort of informal teams. It's not like we're, you know, like people are being hired by a congressional office or by a government agency or anything like that. Just all of those of us who are sort of thinking together on a daily basis about what the Green New Deal should look like and how it's going to unfold are sort of thinking in terms of, we're sort of brainstorming about various people who are, say, thought leaders or industry leaders or government leaders or policy visionaries within each of the subject areas who should be, you know, who we'd want to sort of talk to, we'd want to sort of bring into the same conversation, right? So that's sort of one place where things are sort of moving right now. A second place has to do with that sort of second subject that I mentioned and connects very much, you know, with this first subject. That's to say, the second sort of realm in which there's development underway is when it comes to sort of figuring out what the various governmental levels of government roles will be, right? What's the role of the federal government going to be? What would the role of state governments and what would the role of local governments be? So what we're doing here at the moment is sort of simultaneously thinking in terms, A, of what has to be coordinated at the highest level of coordination, right? So in other words, what sorts of roles would the federal government have to discharge, right? In other words, what part of the Green New Deal division of labor, if we might call it that, is best vested in, right, the federal government? And then by the same token, what level, I mean, what roles within that broad division of labor are sort of best delegated to the state levels and the local levels? Well, it's easier to answer the first two of those, I think the federal level on the one hand and the local level on the other, than it is to answer the state level. So we've been doing most of our thinking, at least right now, in connection with what we might call that sort of top level or bottom level or that kind of ground floor level, and then the kind of, you know, sort of up in the, you know, sort of overseeing level. So let's start with the ground floor first. A big part of the Green New Deal aspiration, as you know, is for the Green New Deal itself to be very much democratically determined, very much democratically instituted, and very much democratically implemented. And that includes, of course, doing things democratically, even when it comes to deciding what has to be done, right? What specific Green New Deal projects are necessary or needed or would be a good idea to pursue. And our thought is that, you know, basically every congressional district of the country, every locality, let's say, of the country, has a population within it that is pretty well situated to understand what is most urgently needed within its, you know, sort of territorial domain, so to speak, or, you know, where it is, right? So in Ithaca, where I spend a good bit of my time, Ithaca, New York, there are very specific needs that we have of a kind of infrastructural character on the one hand, and of a greenification sort of or greenifying character on the other hand. And so we have, of course, you know, very well developed, but nevertheless tentative or provisional views as to what sorts of projects we ought to be pursuing in Ithaca, right? And our thought is that there's a sort of similar story that can be told, again, of every locality in the country, that various localities have ground level ideas of what's needed, what has to be done. So what we're trying to do now is to encourage and facilitate and sort of foster the holding of a kind of basically a multitude of local town hall meetings that can be organized, right, partly by grassroots groups, like, for example, the Sunrise Movement, which has chapters all over the country, as you know, and other groups as well, like the Justice Democrats and other groups on the one hand, and then city councils, mayors, other sorts of local officials on the other, basically to commence the project of holding, in effect, public brainstorming sessions at the local level. And then the hope would be that doing this will generate, in effect, wish lists that will be sort of put forward by every community in the country that can then all be put together in one great big Green New Deal prospective project book, right? You know, you might say that instead of, you know, having binders full of women, as Mitt Romney was saying, we're gonna have, you know, binders full of local Green New Deal wish lists, which seems to make a bit more sense and is a little bit less chilling in its connotations, right? And so that's, we're beginning the process of kind of stimulating or jump-starting or encouraging the holding of these sorts of gatherings. And the thought would be you wouldn't just have, you know, one per locality between now and 2021. The hope is that you'll have a lot of these meetings within each locality between now and 2021 so that basically ideas can be refined a bit, so that more and more people can be brought into the discussion. For example, if your neighbors can't make it to the first town hall meeting on this in your locality, then maybe they can make it to the next one or the next one and so forth. So we want to, you know, in a sense, sort of like an overlay map where you just lay down layer upon layer upon layer with a view to getting a kind of a gradually more detailed picture of what a specific geographical or topography looks like. Sort of similarly, if we have a kind of sequence of overlays that are laid by each local meeting within any individual locality, you'll have a fairly well-developed and detailed set of aspirations or wishes for each locality come 2021. And what that does is it basically yields, I think, three benefits. This is at least one reason I've been pushing this so sort of adamantly or ardently. One is you entirely avoid the principal problem that President Obama was faced with when he took office in 2009. And you'll recall that when he took office, you know, he's saying we're going to engage in a massive stimulus spending program, you know, in order to kind of arrest this free fall that the economy seems to be in since August or September of 2008. But then as soon as he takes office, there were no, and you remember the quote, shovel-ready projects. There was just nothing that people already had kind of figured out needs doing. let alone begun to schematize the doing of. So there's no better time than the present, especially since we have about 18 months now before the next administration takes office, to start getting together those, again, those binders full of shovel-ready projects that are locally determined, at least provisionally. And so that's the first benefit that comes of this. A second benefit that comes of it is that, well, you're probably going to get a much more efficiently implemented Green New Deal if you have that kind of local input, in addition to a much more just and democratic Green New Deal, if that's the way it works. In other words, we're talking about something very much akin to participatory budgeting here. But rather than it just being about participatory budgeting, of course, it's participatory planning, but participatory local planning. So we enable the Green New Deal then to kind of live up to one of those overriding aspirations that we've been articulating in connection with it all along, which is that it be a socially just and optimally, maximally, democratically conducted project as well, right? So you get that sort of second benefit. And then finally, a third benefit, I think, that comes of this is if you get entire communities thinking about what they want to get done through the Green New Deal, you have in so doing mobilized every community in the country to get out there and vote in November to see to it, in November of 2020, to see to it that we actually get people in office who are going to sort of make good on the promise of the Green New Deal, who are actually going to do things. Because now it won't just be a kind of an abstract parlor game where we're talking about the horse race or, you know, oh gosh, you know, how many points is Kamala Harris going to rise in the poll for having pulled out that pre-planned zinger in that debate? Instead of talking about, you know, sort of bull byproduct stories of that kind, we'll be talking about actual concrete measures that people want to get done. And that makes politics a much more sort of visceral and kind of fingertip type pursuit of the populace, rather than just a kind of an armchair speculation game where we basically look at the race as though we're watching a sporting event, right? And then, right? Yeah. So I think that third benefit is a very important one too, right? So that's kind of where we are with thinking on local. Yeah, please do.
Can I interject something? What mechanisms do you have? Because, you know, I reside in two different communities, and one is rural, the other is urban. Constantly, you know, seeing the differences between them. So, like, for example, on the one hand, suppose one community wants to banish the use of plastics, and the other community has to deal with a, you know, multi-trillion-dollar project to re-gear buildings and housing to a new form of energy. Like, and then the effect, the differential between the impact on, for example, climate, between eliminating plastic bags in one community versus, you know, kind of redoing the entire heating and cooling system and conservation system of, you know, many buildings for trillions of dollars. I mean, there's like a huge disparity there, both in terms of cost and in terms of impact. So that's one question, like how does that all balance out? And then the other question I have is just thinking more about the rural community. You may, for example, have people who want to get rid of plastic bags. Again, that's a notable, you know, that's a wonderful thing to do or to think about. But in terms of its overall impact, I think, you know, we all recognize that it's just kind of a baby step, or at least some of us recognize that. And some maybe feel that there's very little that we can do without rocking some boats. So, for example, a second issue in that same community with the plastic bags might be the complete lack of affordable housing for workers. You know, is that a Green New Deal issue, or is it a different issue? It's an issue because of land use and all kinds of sense of protectionism around that, so that, you know, you might have something that a certain segment of the community would like to address, but it may touch on political hot buttons and strains within that community. And what support would there be for people at a local level to deal with those kinds of dynamics and tensions within a community? So that, you know, the best part of the process, you know, stands a better chance of manifesting rather than getting deadlocked by pre-existing agreements.
Right, right. So that kind of tees me up for the sort of other levels, right, of mm-hmm. government that we're sort of thinking in connection with as we sort of, mm-hmm. you know, sort of think through the next stages of the Green New Deal. So if we think in terms of, again, sort of comparative advantages of different levels of government mm-hmm. within the Green New Deal, with some sort of better positioned to discharge some functions and others better positioned to discharge other ones. Well, mm-hmm. one thought that, you know, sort of comes immediately to one's mind when one starts thinking about these things is that, well, at the very least, one role that you might expect higher levels of government to be good at is kind of coordinating or harmonizing or at least ironing out any sort of wrinkles between different local wish lists, right, or different sort of sets of projects that might be preferred mm-hmm. by different localities. So if there were some, say, fundamental, a fundamental tension, say, between the Green New Deal aspirations that a rural locality might have on the one hand and the aspirations that an adjacent or nearby urban locality might have on the other, well, this is a classic case where some form of adjudication has to be done or some form of mediation has to be done, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, maybe a city cleaning project or a city beautification project involves, you know, getting rid of a bunch of junk or, you know, getting rid of a bunch of garbage, and maybe some city officials or city residents who might not be terribly mindful of their neighbors in an adjacent rural area might say, well, how about we just put that all in a new compost landfill right outside of the city limits or something. But then that, of course, makes the air exceedingly smelly, right, for rural residents nearby. Well, right. You know, obviously some kind of mediating has to be done, some kind of a backing and forthing, some kind mm-hmm. of some method of figuring out how to make this least problematic for all parties concerned has to be developed. And among other things, of course, a state-level government or, let's say, a sub-state regional level of government, say, county government, would be a good level at which things of that sort might be done, right? Some kind of mediating of that sort. Sort of similarly, if there's a tendency overall for, let's say, the New York State binder to look significantly different, say, from the Pennsylvania state binder, and mm-hmm. furthermore, to look different in a way that implicates tensions where you can't actually simultaneously satisfy both the New Yorkers and the Pennsylvanians, then again, some kind of interstate mediating or adjudicating has to be done. And that's something, of course, that we would presume would be done, or at least the services enabling that to happen would be at least partly provided by the federal level, by government at the federal level, or by some, you know, via some sort of interstate compact, which I guess you could think of as something sort of regional. And then finally, another thing we have to kind of make sure that we consider here, and this has to do with one particular role that the federal government or the federal level is especially good at, is, you know, not only with respect to sort of coordinating or adjudicating or mediating in the way that I just suggested, but also mm-hmm. in connection with financing, right? I mean, the borrowing power or the bond issuance power or just the spending power of the federal government is qualitatively distinct, right, from the spending power of any state, let alone any locality. So a very important role that the federal government is going to have to play, I think, and I think all of us agree, is going to be in financing various Green New Deal projects at the local or state level that localities and states themselves don't have the wherewithal to finance themselves. And that can be done in any number of ways. It could be done in the form of grants, or it could be done in the form of the Fed or some other federal agency being willing to purchase bond issuances of one kind or another made by localities or by states, even when private sector parties aren't so willing to buy them. Any number of roles or any number of modes of financing could be employed, but what seems to be common to all of them would be that the federal government, with its again, qualitatively different financing capacities would have to, you know, play a major role when it comes to Green New Deal financing. So, you know, you might think of it then as, okay, if we talk somewhat schematically, a rough and ready description of the division of labor would be to say that the localities have primary responsibility for determining the wish lists or the projects, not sole responsibility, but primary responsibility. The feds have primary responsibility for the financing. And then the state or regional levels have a sort of, you might say, kind of first at the sort of first wave or first gate responsibilities for sort of coordinating or reconciling any tensions between local wish lists or local aspirations on the part of various localities, right? With the feds capable of stepping in to do similar such coordinating when regional or state action along those lines isn't adequate to the task. And again, that's a very rough and ready schematization, and it raises almost as many questions, I suspect, as it addresses. But at least we have a kind of a first intuitive pass at the question of the division of labor there, and it by and large conforms, I think, to what people often have had in mind in the American context for centuries when they've talked about so-called federalism, and what people in other jurisdictions have in mind when they talk about subsidiarity.
When they talk about what?
Subsidiarity. So outside of America, right, people in Asia or in Europe, often they have a word that roughly corresponds to our word federalism, and they call it subsidiarity. And the idea here is that basically every level of government should have primary responsibility for what an entity acting at that level would be most competent or able to handle, right? So the theory would be then that local government is closer, of course, to local problems and can be more readily informed, right, by the citizenry within local areas of local needs. And so it makes sense, right, for local levels of government to have kind of primary responsibility, or at least the first provisional responsibility for determining what needs doing at the local level. But then when it comes to coordinating between localities, a level above local, maybe say state level, is better for that. And then if we have to coordinate between states, then of course the federal level or some sub-federal regional level of decision making is best for that. And then similarly, when it comes to financing, again, the feds just have a capacity to finance that no other level of government even has anything even remotely approaching. Again, it's so different that it's qualitatively different, not just quantitatively distinct, you know. So if you think in terms of parceling out roles in keeping with the comparative advantages of each level of governance, then you're thinking in terms that people outside of America refer to as subsidiarity, and that people in America have classically sort of thought of under the term federalism.
Mm-hmm. How would there be some kind of federal mandates, for example, to do with decarbonization? And, you know, it's kind of a prime concern and how that matter should be handled, because, if it's left to localities, they may all elect to be, if somebody's going to put a screen up against, you know, the sky to block the sun, that's kind of... It's not a solution I would personally recommend, but that's like a kind of at a meta level, and then there are other solutions which might be more local, such as regenerative agriculture. So, how would the coordination or the decision making and policy decision making as to the paths, kind of coordinate and spell out in regard to how to accomplish that? Because, from a carbon tax to, building the soil, So how does that work in terms of actually, that particular?
Sure. Yeah. So there, in a way, there are two questions that are implicated by this. And the first has to do with the possibility of competing jurisdictional roles between different levels of government rather than simply, mutually complementary or mutually, sort of supporting jurisdictional roles between levels of government. In other words, what do you do when it's not just a matter of every level of government doing what it does best, but when we're also talking about a higher level of government having to ensure that some truly national goals get accomplished, even if there's not a whole lot of local interest? That's one question that's implicated by your question. The other, of course, which is, I don't think you're directly meaning to implicate, maybe, but it's kind of hovering there as a kind of, as a something that would be implicated, or might even be a kind of a subtext, has to do with, all right, or, you know, do you choose carrots or sticks in the event that there is the necessity for there to be some sort of federal mandating, or, you know, sort of federal, the feds making something happen, even though some localities aren't particularly interested in making that happen. So starting with the first thing first, this is, in a way, this is not a problem that's, or a question that's sort of unique to the Green New Deal or new to the Green New Deal. It's a question that comes up, it's a sort of meta question in a way that comes up in connection with any federated system, right? Any subsidiaristic form of government. So if you've got a federal government like, a federated kind of government like ours, where we have a national government on the one hand and then separate state governments on yet another, on another hand, I should say, and then local governments on yet another, there's always going to be the question of, well, are there some things that we want to be nationwide, even if there is local objection in some cases? What if you want to abolish slavery, for example, and we think that right. that should be, you know, basically every human being living in the United States has a fundamental human right not to be enslaved. And yet the state of Alabama in 1850, you know, doesn't like that idea. You know, something we have to figure out a way of, you know, basically dealing with that problem. Similarly, when it came to, you know, the civil rights legislation or voting rights legislation in the 1960s, you know, there were recalcitrant states, and that kind of thing happens all the time. So in a way, this is just the Green New Deal version of that kind of hardy perennial of federal a federated government, right? So the question is, all right, so, you know, how do we deal with that if that happens, and in what realms or in what respects is it likely to happen? Well, my guess is that we can answer that question sort of in an easy way or in a hard way. And we do that by referring to, or by kind of proceeding to the second kind of question I mentioned is sort of implicated by your question, and that is the carrots versus sticks business, right? So insofar as we're able to use the method of carrots or inducements rather than the method of sticks, my guess is that these problems are easier to solve, right? We either offer inducements to states or localities that are not themselves interested in certain Green New Deal projects that we have decided really ought to be done everywhere, or we offer direct federal assistance to individuals who want to act in keeping with those federal goals, even when they're not getting any support, let's say, from their localities or from their states, right? So, for example, here's an analogy. As you know, public education in this country is financed primarily at the local level. And indeed, you know, sort of taxing jurisdictions in most of the country kind of correspond to school district jurisdictions, right? If you live within the jurisdiction of this particular school district, then you pay its particular taxes. And that has a particularly pernicious effect on inequality in the country because, of course, some localities are poor and some are rich. And the public schools in the rich localities are well-financed and the public schools in the local ones are not. And, you know, as you know, there was a very important suit filed that against this sort of arrangement, saying it was, in essence, a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution back in the 1970s that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And this is the San Antonio Independent School District versus Rodriguez case, where the Supreme Court said, well, no, actually, the Equal Protection Clause doesn't give you any right to a roughly equal sort of public education if you live in a poor district to those that people get in richer districts. Now, you know, what does this mean? Now, if the court had found differently, then in effect, this is, again, the Supreme Court, in effect, what we would have had would have been sticks being employed, right? We would have had essentially the federal, a branch of the federal government saying, well, localities, you're going to have to do something about this because we can't, it just won't do, right, to have the poor going to inferior schools to those that the rich go to. And that would have been probably a pretty difficult stick to comply with in some cases, because in some cases, entire states are kind of poor. It was a bad decision, I think, but in a certain sense, it wasn't as harmful as it might have been, because it's not clear that, it's not immediately clear how the situation would have been remedied had the court found differently. On the other hand, if we think in terms of carrots rather than sticks, or if we think in terms of, you know, giving rather than taking away, there's a very obvious solution to this, and that is direct federal subsidies, right, sent to localities that have underperforming public schools because of a poor tax base, so as essentially to kind of level up, you know, rather than potentially leveling down. We bring about something closer to equality in public education by channeling more federal funds to those areas that are most in need of them in order to kind of, again, top up public education in poor areas, rather than, you know, I don't know, forcing some sort of a direct redistribution from rich school districts to poor school districts within particular states. Now, it seems to me that there are going to be a lot of analogs to that very, you know, basically a lot of things that will be sort of structurally identical to that very situation when it comes to the Green New Deal. But in other words, some states and some localities will not elect to pursue particular kinds of Green New Deal project, even though if we really want the federal goals of the Green New Deal to be brought into being, those localities would have to do these things. And some of these localities might refrain from doing these things simply because they don't think they can afford them. It's just there's just not that much money or that much in the way of resources in this particular locality. Well, that's easily remedied, right, by federally directing funds to those areas in the same way that we can federally direct funds to poor school districts. So we might even think in terms of Green New Deal districts, kind of analogous to, you know, school districts, and say, you know, districts that don't have a good tax base and that are more in need of funding and that are refraining from pursuing some of the green of the truly national or federal Green New Deal goals, like carbon neutrality, simply because it's more expensive for them to do it, or at least more comparatively expensive because they're poorer, we can remedy that with the carrot of federal funding or federal subsidizing, it seems to me. So there's, you know, I think that sort of two-part answer to your question, I think, is at least the basic form or the general form that a satisfactory answer to your question would take. And so we're sort of thinking along those lines, basically, when we think about the Green New Deal.
Yeah, it's really interesting because hearing about this level of discussion and planning, I think, makes it more real in terms of picturing it. And also, it probably can also answer the objections that would be in certain quarters who would automatically assume that, you know, some of these decisions or these initiatives would be to their detriment or wouldn't be possible. Due to economic scarcity, and therefore people would be fearfully opposing them because it seems unrealistic and it seems like a, you know, a pipe dream or something, where when you start talking, you know, kind of presenting the dynamics of it on this kind of level, then you can see how some of these objections could be answered.
That's the thing. I think these are easily answered. Yeah. I mean, one quick point here in that connection. I mean, people, you know, a lot of people, I think, maybe either never knew or maybe they've forgotten that one of the really interesting things about the original New Deal was that it really did have projects in literally every congressional district of the country. Every district had New Deal projects. And when I say that, I mean projects that the federal government was facilitating the execution of and indeed helping to finance, in some cases entirely financing. And, you know, there were two wonderful virtues that that doing the New Deal in that way had. One was, of course, it got political buy-in from both sides of the proverbial aisle, rather in the way the Defense Department and defense expenditures have support from both sides of the congressional aisle to this very day, because the defense industries and the Defense Department have projects to this very day in every U.S. congressional district. But, you know, when we talk about the Green New Deal or the original New Deal as distinguished from defense spending, we're talking about technologies of construction rather than destruction, right? And then the second sort of virtue that something like that has is, of course, it means it is indeed more socially just and more democratic, right? I mean, if this really is supposed to be for everybody, well, then the benefits should inure to everybody. Literally everybody should win. Literally everybody should be better off. And there's no reason we can't do that, because what we're talking about is a massive increase in the national wealth. And I'm thinking in terms of, when I talk about wealth, I don't mean just dollar-denominatable wealth, but other kinds of wealth too. But even if we were to restrict ourselves only to economically monetizable or measurable wealth, there's going to be an immense growth in the national wealth. And anytime you're going to grow wealth to that extent, you are in theory capable of making everybody better off. And the problem that you're then confronted with is essentially just an engineering problem. You just, okay, well, how do we make sure that it actually does go to everybody? But that's peanuts compared to, you know, getting the wealth generated in the first place. And the Green New Deal is virtually guaranteed just enormously to increase the national wealth.
You know, that's the part of the story that I don't think everybody sees, because when the plan was first articulated, it's, know, with the need to redress issues of justice, which is a very real need, then in the first description, it kind of would seem to people who would not categorize themselves in that, you know, in as being, you know, like indigenous people or in an area of environmental damage, but who might be, you know, in a weakened economic position, and then you have that polarization occurring. You know, they didn't maybe identify themselves as being beneficiaries along with everyone else, or in fact that this would be benefiting, you know, the majority of the population. And so to me, that part of the story, without displacing the original concerns, could be told a little bit more and better in order to get more of a universal buy-in, and for people to see that this scarcity model has really, in, you know, at different levels, it's afflicted, you know, a substantial portion of the population. We're not trapped in it, and we could actually create something different. That's really hard for people to grasp, because it's almost like Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah, it really is. It is kind of, I think you're right, like Stockholm syndrome, right? Or it reminds me of those experiments that were done. These are just horribly inhumane. But these, you know, I remember they tortured us in psychology class when I was in junior high school with film footage of, you know, electric jolts being administered to rats in cages, right? And they'd be, you know, peacefully, you know, kind of sucking on the water bottle or chewing on food pellets or whatever. And all of a sudden there's a little jolt and they're freaked out. They jump up, they kind of look around wondering what's going on, and then they kind of resume drinking or chewing, and then there's another jolt. And, you know, by the time you get to the third or fourth jolt, they start, you know, biting each other, and they become aggressive with one another, even though it's irrational. I mean, it's not in any sense apparent to one rat that another rat is pulling the lever to make the electricity flow. It's just the trauma and the shock itself leads to a kind of fight or flight aggressiveness. And I think that's, you know, that's probably part and parcel of all this. There's also, you know, we've been, I think, led into sort of thinking in terms of two sort of pictures that kind of hold us captive. And these two pictures are quite insidious, and they don't really depict any actual realities, which makes them even more horrifying. But so one is that, and they're kind of interrelated. One is that, well, you know, there's just this kind of given pie. The pie is of a certain size, and so, you know, if I get more, it means you get less. It's just that simple. You know, the pie is just static, right? And then the second is that, you know, you've got an entire class of Americans who are poor, who are just takers. And so you put that together with the pie idea, and they're, you know, they're taking too much of the pie. They're taking away the pie and preventing the rest of us from having our fair share of the pie that we actually baked or that we made, which is, of course, rubbish and nonsense, right? And the easiest way, I think, to counteract these things is to sort of point to, you know, even just with pictures, you could just show people, look, let's just represent the economy in the form of a pie and note, right, that the area of this circle is growing with every bloody year, right? And note furthermore that you can determine or at least significantly influence the rate of the growth of that of that pie, right, the growth of that area of that circle, through various forms of non-wasteful, truly investment-style spending. That's the first point. And then the second point is to note that actually you increase the rate of that growth immensely by focusing first on, or at the very least, making sure you don't forget the people who are at the bottom of the income and wealth ladder, because we know from all sorts of empirical observations, and even from, this is you can even sort of learn this through inspecting your own mind, even through sort of armchair and in self-introspection, that basically people who are down at the bottom of the wealth and income distribution consume a much greater portion of the earnings that they earn, meaning that they themselves stimulate much more economic growth once they're actually bringing in an income than do other people, right? Imagine that you and I, Allison, or let's say we're rich people, wouldn't that be wonderful? We have, each of us has like 10 yachts, right? And then, you know, there's a big new increment of income that comes. And if it comes your way or my way, you know, it's not like we're going to go and buy an 11th yacht. We're kind of maxed out on consumption. So we're more likely just to kind of stuff it under the mattress or put it in a bank account or, you know, speculate with it on some secondary or tertiary financial market that just inflates bubbles in financial instruments, but doesn't do anything to increase aggregate demand and productive activity that enhances employment. If, on the other hand, the same increment of income were to go towards somebody who's quite poor and is not really even able to max out on consumption because, you know, they're still even hungry, well, those people are immediately going to be spending that additional income on consumption. And that is exactly the kind of thing that drives greater employment and hence greater production and hence greater wealth still. So there's definitely a virtuous circle, a kind of a snowball effect in the good sense of the word, when it comes to ensuring that those who are not at the top of the income distribution are, you know, benefiting by infusions of capital, infusions of investment money. So, you know, we can grow, the pie always grows, literally, except for recessions or depressions, the pie is always growing at some rate. And so that means it's already a mistake to think in sort of zero-sum terms. But then it also, we can adjust the rate at which it grows, and we can make it grow much faster than it has been growing, precisely by seeing to it that the least of these, to use the old biblical expression, are definitely, you know, among the first beneficiaries of the initial public expenditures. That grows, to use the macroeconomist's term of art, you've got a much higher multiplier associated with public investment when you are ensuring, right, that those who are not at the top are benefiting. Then everybody literally benefits, including those at the top. You know, to go back to the old, you know, 19th century metaphors, you know, trickle down on the one hand and rising tide on the other. Trickle down is absurd and nonsensical. We know, as a matter of just empirical reality, that trickle down, that just doesn't trickle down. On the other hand, the rising tide lifting all the boats, that's true. It can, provided that you ensure that you're, you know, raising the tide where the smaller boats are waiting to be floated, you know. And then once that's happening, then you do actually, everybody actually does benefit, including the wealthy.
Well, it's interesting because the thing that I always feel from, you know, my kind of baseline contemplations of life and everything is that everyone needs better quality food, and most especially people who have been eating junk food and having health problems and not able to access or afford good quality food really could use healthy food more than anyone. And, you know, I would like to see either an infusion into the healthy food system of production that could feed them and therefore enhance their health, enhance their productivity, extend their lives, or perhaps that will come about through their employment through these various means. And then, you know, in a Rube Goldberg-like effect, if there's more, you know, people who need the healthy food, and it's not just an elite thing that I get to belong to a food co-op and I get organic food, but no one else, you know, can access it. You know, then it actually creates a demand for the farmers to grow such food, and then they can, you know, kind of bury, take the carbon into the soil through those agricultural practices, and then we actually also have a potentially profound environmental effect, not just, you know, nationally, but also even globally. And it all comes out of the engine of food. So I was, you know, as a long-time kind of food is the heart of everything person, I was kind of frustrated with, I mean, I was like tantalized by the mention, but frustrated with where Kamala Harris took that in the debate, because I actually think it's central, and it's also one of the biggest community centering functions. That is, you know, if there were more even community opportunities for food rather than, you know, just everyone belaboring it in their kitchen or whatever, just for their immediate group. So, you know, I'd love to, but I mean, that is actually where, you know, you start with the most basic subsistence in some ways in also creating the wealth and the nourishment, and I think that also goes against this whole idea that in fact what we, which we've otherwise been taught, that is for us to tighten our belts, it's for us to starve, this, you know, the people have to pedal harder like little rats, you know, on a you know, a treadmill or a bicycle or something, and otherwise they, you know, they get what they deserve. And so you know, so we're really, I mean, what I see here and what you're saying is that there's like also just, there's a potential to create these much more, out of this positive paradigm, you know, this whole thing can evolve. And so it's a matter of kind of almost being freed from these pre-existing constructs that have left us beholden in this certain kind of way. And there's great potential for that to happen.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, there's a we have a tendency, I think, just as human beings, to kind of carry sort of pictures in our heads that we associate with certain ideas or with certain assumptions, or well, oftentimes, oftentimes we'll hold an assumption that's then captured in a particular picture, and oftentimes the picture is just a tremendous distortion of reality, and one of these distortions is this idea that, well, somehow it's just a, the economy is just like this kind of statically sized pie, and you know, basically my getting something means you're not getting something, and you know, part of our task, of course, is to make clear, is basically to replace those false pictures or those misleading pictures with true pictures or sort of non-distorting pictures to kind of get the idea across. And then the second thing I was going to point out really quickly is, you know, in what you were just saying is so very true and so very important. And there's, in addition, there's even a kind of a corollary to it that might be worth noting. And that is that, you know, if we actually got people healthier because they were eating healthier and breathing healthier and, you know, transporting themselves in healthier ways and so forth, that itself is an immense wealth booster too, not only in terms of the quality of life that can't be quantified or measured or monetized, but also in terms of elements of the quality of life that can't be monetized. For example, just the sheer deadweight loss of medical expenditures that people have to make when they're not eating well, when they're, you know, when they're not exercising properly, or when their lives are not materially healthy, right? A materially healthy life is a materially much less expensive life, you might say, than is a materially unhealthy life. So you get an additional boost to the size of the pie, so to speak, simply by trimming off or cutting off that source of deadweight loss.
That's right.
So then you
were
going
to
ask something
really
about...
true.
Right?
I'm wondering what
so
time
I think you were
going to
transition
are we
to
going
a time
to see all of... Yeah, I was, well, actually, in terms of time, we're also coming down to like the last 5 minutes, 4 minutes of the show, so
sure,
we may have to have a subsequent conversation. Let's just end with this question. How well do you think we're doing at getting the message through to people that, you know, despite this barrage, or I call it the parade of candidates, you know, these this showpiece of all these candidates, which, as you point out, are, you know, just giving little sound bites, and we're guessing about who they are, and you know, kind of playing a TV game show is in some way. You know, thank
Sounds
you,
good.
Listeners, for being for being with us on this edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Stand up, heads tall, keep marching forward in company with all our relations.
Well, 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 well. there was the sky.